Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show on the Log Talk Radio Network, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. This is our For Our Kids series of shows that we do every other Thursday night, which is produced by Deborah Madison and Eugenia Couture, who I'll bring on in just a moment. They are responsible for the content of this series of shows, and we're proud to say that they've done perhaps 50 or more of these shows that are all collected in an archive that you can very easily find by going to NASCA.org, our website, NASCA.org/For Our Kids. And if you type in NASCA.org/For Our Kids, you'll see all the shows they've done, all the descriptions of all the shows they've done, and each one in turn becomes an on-demand show within about a half an hour of its completion. Tonight's show is, of course, at the top of that list, and we're proud to do this show on tonight's topic, No More Silence. Without further ado, let me introduce you two and bring them on the air, Gina and Deborah from British Columbia. Good evening, ladies. How are you tonight?
Good. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill. We're doing great.
Good.
We have a pretty full panel tonight. Tonight, we're really lucky. We have Senator Alan Clark from Arkansas on the line with us. We also have senatorial candidate Bruce Nathan. We have Jim Black, founder and lead researcher of Angel Eyes Over Texas. And we have Lori Fortin, and both of them were part of the group that helped to draft and present the Family First Prevention Services Act that we're going to be speaking about tonight. And also tonight we have advocate Brian Kinter. And all of these people have been working tirelessly to bring awareness to the CPS issues and to fight for changes that are much, much needed. So we have a lot of people and a powerful panel, so we're going to get to it.
Well, I want to confirm that your audio is terrible right now. It sounds like you're underwater. I was able to discern most of what you said, and I hope our listeners were too. But I'm actually going to make the suggestion that you hang up and quickly call back in if you would, because otherwise we don't want
Does
to lose you
better?
And what you're saying.
Is this,
you sound like
okay,
you're underwater. Could you hang up? Please hang up and call in, get a different satellite. Okay. I'll handle it for a moment. In case you didn't understand, the description of the show should be in front of you, but in case it's not, we're doing a show on No More Silence. And the first part of the show reads, as Martin Luther King Jr. stated once, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. That's when our lives begin to end. So that's the premise of the show. We have a dynamic panel of folks with us. I'm probably going to ask Deborah and Eugenia to reintroduce them now, and let me see if this is better. Hey, hi, ladies. You're back.
Hi. Can you hear us better now?
Oh, it's much better. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Okay. Tonight we have Arkansas Senator Alan Clark. We also have senatorial candidate Bruce Nathan. We have Jim Black, who's the founder and lead researcher of Angel Eyes Over Texas, and we have Lori Fortin, and both of these two were part of a group that helped to draft and present the Family First Prevention Services Act to legislature, and we also have Advocate Brian Kinter, and all of these people have been working tirelessly to deal with the issues that we're facing with our child protective services all over North America and in their areas specifically, and looking for transparency and accountability and definite change, which is very much needed. So we wanted to start with Senator Clark tonight because he had a very powerful story with how he came to be aware of this issue and involved.
Hello?
Okay, Senator, welcome to the air. Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. We're so appreciative for you taking the time out and coming on our show.
Like I said, thank you for having me.
I just wanted to ask you how you first became aware of this issue and what brought it to your attention.
Well, 2 years ago, I was completely oblivious to the problem. In January of 2015, seven children were removed from a home in my Senate district, in my home county. And I actually, we just started session. I was paying very little attention, but I got a number of phone calls and began to check into it and assumed that the authorities were probably right. But as I checked into it, we ran into a number of problems, including that for about 30 days they wouldn't give me any information, and finally had to hold the DHS budget. We happened to be in session in budget hearings. And finally, they shared with me the synopsis of the investigation. And we went from there. There were 21 true findings. I didn't know at the time that the true findings meant that they had found the people guilty. But one of them was for burning. And I thought, well, these people are terrible. They belong under the jail. And I searched the investigation to find what the burning was, looking for cigarette burns or scalding water, and found that these people had used a health supplement on a growth on a child's face 2 years before and had caused a slight chemical burn, as similar to what Compton W would do. And I thought, I cannot believe they would have found these people guilty of child abuse for that. And then the further I dug into it, the worse it was. And that's how I got into it.
And not to interrupt you, but you did say something that they had been found guilty. Now, they were not found guilty by a judge and jury, though, correct?
No, that's the terrible thing that I didn't know, most legislators don't know, is, in fact, DHS takes offense when you use the word guilty because it's not criminal, it's civil, and so there's the investigator finds you guilty with the true findings. And you don't have a right to an attorney. You don't have a right to face your accuser. In fact, usually the accuser is anonymous, and it's completely upside down. We want to protect children, but this is the system is crazy for someone who's never dealt with it.
And you had actually quite the journey in trying to get to the bottom of this and to get the information. And I know you uncovered some really, really shocking facts along the way. And I'm going to ask you to share that with us because I found that to be quite amazing.
Well, there is, you know, we could take up more than this program with everything, with the whole story, the way it happened. But once I got the investigation and saw the burning and that wasn't the case, I began to look at the other allegations and the other true findings, which also didn't make any sense, and began to go to the DHS and CACD, which is Crimes Against Children Division of the state police, who did the investigation in this case. And because, you know, I'm not saying they're not guilty. I don't know the people, so I'm not saying they're not child abusers, but you haven't proven that they're child abusers. This is very serious stuff. Just prove it to me. And I was told multiple times, if you just knew what we knew, you would know they were guilty. Well, under Arkansas law, they have to tell me everything, which we had finally gotten straight after I held their budget. I couldn't share it with anyone else. I can share some of it now because the family's now made it public. But so I said, well, I've asked for everything. What haven't you given me? And so we continued to have that conversation for months. And because I was afraid I might be wrong, I spent hundreds of hours. I interviewed the local DCFS workers in Garland County. Even through the sheriff's department, normally you couldn't even get, even a state senator couldn't, but I was able to get the names and phone numbers of accusers and call them, and they were reasonable people. They had not tried to hurt this family. They thought there might be problems. But the more I dug into it, and I found out that the local DCFS people didn't think they were guilty, which is not the case in every story, but in this case they didn't. And so I was just amazed that, and as a state senator, I kept saying, why don't y'all just overturn these true findings and let these people go? And stubbornly, they held on through 21 months. The folks that started January 15 and December 15, they finally had their appeal hearing. And the investigator admitted on the stand that they didn't have the evidence for any of the true findings. There were 12 educational neglect and 9 others. It was the 9 others that were subject to the appeal, because the 12 educational neglect, 6 against each parent for the 6 school-aged children, they had pled to in order to get their kids back. I mean, the state had held their kids for 60 days, and what they were found guilty of, or the true finding, was that they didn't register their kids as homeschoolers. But at one point during this time, they had told the high-ups in DHS had told me, well, these children were as much as 3 years behind age and grade level. And I said, you know, my sister homeschooled, my best friend homeschooled, but that would be abuse if they weren't teaching their kids. So I asked for the test results. It took another 4 weeks for me to get them, and all the kids were within normal range. One was gifted, one was a little slower, but they were all within normal range. And so all they had was that they hadn't registered for homeschooling. I said, you wouldn't put somebody on the child maltreatment list, which means if they were an RN or a child care worker or a law enforcement officer and other things, that they would not just lose their job, they'd lose their career for being put on that list. But anyway, they did. And so they won their appeal in December of the 9 counts because, like I said, the investigator admitted on the stand that they didn't have the evidence. Then they've been continued to appeal the educational neglect. And in April, one of the children who would have just finished the 10th grade took their GED and scored college ready or almost college ready in every subject and is now enrolled in college. And I came back to DHS again and said, why will you not let these people go? Why do you force them to continue to appeal and defy them? I mean, how can they be negligent when they've got a 10th grader who's college ready? How can they be educationally negligent? And anyway, recently, last month, DHS issued a do not defend, which means that their next appeal, DHS attorneys will not show up, so they will win. They will finally be free of the system after 21 months. The part of the reason, I can't tell you why they finally did the do not defend, other than a couple of conversations I had with them. But there was an email that I heard about September 10th. And DHS has never, even as a state senator, if I don't know it exists, now if I know it exists and ask for it, I can get it. But if I don't know it exists, I'm not going to get it. And so I heard that this email existed September 10th, over a year and a half later. And I called the local supervisor who I heard had written this email, and I asked if she had expressed an opinion. I didn't know she existed, and I asked if she had expressed an opinion on this case, and she said, I don't want to talk to you. I'll lose my job if I do. And I said, I was taken aback by that a little bit, but it's not the first time I've been told that. And I asked again, I said, did you express an opinion on the Stanley case? Well, it doesn't matter. I wasn't on the Stanley case. I asked again. And then I said, did you have a written opinion? I wasn't on the Stanley case. It doesn't matter. And finally I said, did you write an email? And she said, yes, I did. And I said, I want it. And she said, you have a subpoena. And I said, I'll get one. We didn't have to get a subpoena. I went back to the state level, and they retrieved it for me. But it was part of the everything that I had asked for. And in the email, now, there in Arkansas, while we as legislators can get our hands on everything, we can't reveal any of it. And this email, according to our lawyers, this particular email, I couldn't even reveal. I could tell another legislator existed, and they could ask for it. I could tell the governor it existed, and he could ask for it. But if I shared it with them as a Class A misdemeanor and a $2,500 fine. And so anyway, thankfully someone leaked this last Thursday, so I can, well, I can't share the email with you. I can read what's in the newspaper. I still have my First Amendment rights. And it says, the email said the CACD, that's a Crimes Against Children Division of State Police, case against the Stanleys, feels like the ultimate violation of a family's freedom to live their own culture. Now, this is our DCFS supervisor the morning after the children were removed from their home. It goes on to say, the email said that the Stanleys' unconventional parenting didn't rise to the level of abuse or neglect. And then I'll skip down here to another direct quote. From reports, this is the DCFS supervisor writing to two of her superiors and to CACD. From reports, the search warrant did not find anything that would constitute the children being severely maltreated. It appears to me the only thing this family has done is not conform to modern society and how certain government officials feel they should be living. And, you know, it's just amazing, not only that our own DCFS supervisor told us. I mean, this is a case where they actually did their job right, which is not unusual. We have wonderful people working there, did their job right, said we've messed up. She was removed from the case within 24 hours, and this has been hidden until last month. And now that it's out, many legislators are livid. And because not only could I not investigate this because they said that they were protecting children and families, you know, I couldn't investigate the cover-up because I couldn't share the information. It's just amazing what these people believe they can keep secret.
Well, and as you, as a senator, if you are having that much trouble getting the information, I mean, it must be absolutely overwhelming for an average citizen.
Exactly. I mean, and that's one of the things that I have told them at DHS over and over is, you know, here I am just constantly harassing you that you've got to, you know, you don't have the evidence and you're not listening to me. And as you said, and then when we find information, we can't share it. I mean, I made absolutely sure that these people weren't guilty, and then it didn't matter. And then their response was, you can't tell anybody. And again, I chair the committee that's looking into this. And so we've had some very interesting meetings with me visiting with our lawyers, the legislative lawyers versus the DHS lawyers, and saying, how can I bring this information out without breaking the law? And of course, we brought some of it out. It has been very hard. At first they did not admit any wrongdoing. And over the time, they admitted that there were problems in the agency and that they need to be fixed. And we're working on some legislative fixes as we go into session in January. But more importantly, we're working with the governor. We hope for some major structural changes within the agency.
And if you don't mind, Senator, Brian Kinter, one of our advocates on tonight, does have a question for you.
Sure.
Go ahead, Brian.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Deborah. Yeah, I want to find out, one, what steps are being taken to remove this law for the books that if you see these crimes, I mean, our moral conscience and moral compass dictates that we ought to be able to speak up about this. And this is the bureaucracy, I think, that's in every state that they run you through, and they make it like, you know, hidden information and you can't obtain or get to it. What steps are being taken to correct that, number one? Number two is the other question is that did not the Stanleys file suit against this state, and then whom carries the responsibility for that taking and stealing these children from their homes?
The first question, we have the first step, it was to persistently, other legislators have wanted to, and I've had a lot of support, was first to uncover the problems, and we had to make them known to the public and make them known to the legislators through a very difficult process where we were being told we couldn't do it. That's number one. Second is we are reviewing legislation. We're, I don't know what the level of support is going to be until we get into the session, but we're writing legislation to change some of these laws. One of the reasons why I would guess that it's the same across the country is I've been told, you know, for over a year now that a lot of this is federal, that we've adopted some of these laws, but we can't change some of it. I've found that we can change it much more than they will admit, But in order to get funding, this is all the way the federal government always controls the states. In order to get the DHS funding, which is a significant amount, you have to agree to adopt certain laws. So a lot of this is going back to the federal government. Now, what was the third question?
The third question was, is that who takes the responsibility for the actions in which the CPS workers illegally remove these children from the home? Is there not a liability there upon the state?
I believe so. The state has immunity, but I think that these folks will win. And I hate it for the taxpayers of Arkansas, but the Stanleys, no one should be put through what they were put through. And we could have – It was understandable to go out and for an investigation. There were some very serious charges made. But, you know, I personally went to DCFS and CACD a number of times, mostly by phone, but we met in person because I'm at the Capitol all the time. And I took an offer to them from the Stanleys and from their attorney last May, June, July, in that time frame, several times, and said, if you will – overturn these true findings so that they don't have to fight this anymore. If you will give them a private apology, it doesn't have to be written, it doesn't have to be public, just apologize to them, there won't be a lawsuit. And they just stubbornly continue to go down this trail, and of course it's led to where I hoped it would lead because I had uncovered that they just simply were not guilty. And so now they have filed a lawsuit, and they unfortunately, they deserve to win because no one should ever be treated this way, especially once you know. And of course, in uncovering this email, that's a terrible – is one thing you think, well, just maybe they don't find me credible. And then you find an email that's existed since the morning after these children were taken where our expert, the state's expert, had said the same thing. And a lot of this is the Crimes Against Children Division. We have a two-headed monster in Arkansas. No one else has this. We have DCFS, and then we have Crimes Against Children Division. They both can investigate. Neither one can overrule the other. And in this case, DCFS actually got it right. I know that's not the stories you normally hear, and I'm thankful they exist. I hate it that they do some of these terrible things. But CACD was the one that conducted this investigation. DCFS knew they were wrong from the start. Some higher-ups, didn't have the guts to overrule them. And CACD kept stubbornly insisting that these attorneys show up and fight the Stanleys in court. So in our case, Crimes Against Children Division of the State Police, I believe are the people who are the guilty ones.
Well, I want to go on the record of saying that, number one, I applaud your efforts for taking the bull by the horn and standing up, and I applaud that. And I hope and pray that you'll reach out to the other senators across this nation to bring about a change, because we have laws on the books, according to Public Law 104-193, as to what the state can and cannot do, and yet this story of the Stanley, unfortunately, is a common theme across this land, and countless families are being torn apart by a system that's brutalized by the incentives for Title IV funding.
Yes,
Brian, I'm just going to interject here too and have Senator Clark explain something that he did explain to me that I actually didn't know, and about the incredible difficulty it is to meet with other senators and discuss cases and issues like this.
Well, this is an Arkansas law. The laws in all states are not exactly the same, and again, I'm barely and not really an expert on Arkansas, much less anywhere else. But these laws have been passed because of the federal law. They've been required to pass some type of law on these things. And so our law spells out that, because I know some states that legislators can't even do what I do, which is that I can find out anything on a case. If I know what questions to ask, now I've got to know what questions to ask, and the further I've gone along, the more I know, because they're not going to volunteer anything. But if I know what questions to ask, I can find out anything. I can't share it then with the public. Lots of things I can share with other legislators one-on-one, but we cannot in a committee discuss a specific case. That is just flat out against the law. So it is impossible to investigate wrongdoing, to investigate cover-ups, et cetera, when you can't talk about a case. And that's even once the family has, once a case has been closed and has waived their right, which makes absolutely no sense because it doesn't, we're not protecting the family at all. And I have come to find in our state, and again, some wonderful people that work for these agencies, despite all the structural problems and the bad people. But I have come to any time that they bring up that we're protecting children and family, I cringe because that means we're covering something up. But because we as legislators want to protect children and families too, and they act like in the press that we're just wanting to go out here and, you know, and spill all this private information about all these children and families, and nothing could be further from the truth. And so we're working to find a way. We have found that the federal law is not as restrictive as what they originally told us. And so we're looking to find a way to change state law. And still, I hate it, but we probably have no choice but to comply with federal law. But unless we come to a sticking point where it's just violating constitutional rights, and whether I can get passed or not, we'll fight that. But no, we cannot. Three of us together cannot discuss discuss wrongdoing in a case.
Which I didn't know myself, and I'm willing to bet most people don't, and that's what makes it so hard for investigation into issues like this. I know Jim Black had a question for you too, Senator.
Okay.
Yes, Senator. Basically, I believe you answered it without knowing, but I had heard that y'all had the crimes against children through the state police, but I thought that was y'all's only investigative entity. What you're saying that CPS still has their own investigators in addition to the police department?
Absolutely. There's more than one way that these cases get reported, but the anonymous hotline is the main way. And they do, if it's more criminal, then it goes to CACD. If it's not likely to be criminal, it goes to DCFS, although that's not always the case. It's a very complicated and I think messy. That's my opinion. But yes, but both definitely do investigations. It's very hard to for the indoctrinated, it's very difficult to get down to how it all works.
Okay, because that has been something that I, of course, with our new commissioner in Texas, having been being an ex-Texas Ranger, that we're moving more toward forensic investigations, because so many times when there has been a crime committed, the social workers don't know how to preserve evidence, and so, but. I don't believe that there should be a dual path on that, but there should be a set person to go out and do the initial evaluation and then direct it to the necessary parties from there. And that struck me kind of strange, and I can see where it could be a messy situation.
Well, and you would think, because it's crimes against children, the vision of the state police, you would think that these are law enforcement officers, but they are not. And you know, from working on a few individual cases, it would be unfair for me to characterize. But I do not find them to be their investigators to be superior in any way to DCFS investigators. I could be mistaken, but they do have the force of the state police behind them. But they are not themselves law enforcement officers.
I'd like to actually get in Dr. Jim Singer as well. I think he's got a question that he'd like to throw in there. Are you there?
Yes, I am, and thank you, Senator, for your kindness and your dedication. I wanted to know what precipitated this investigation and what perpetuated this injustice.
These people were different. You know, they homeschooled. They had different religious beliefs. And that's really it. I have said many times lately, I didn't say it early on, but as it has gone on and the state has continued to persecute them, I said, you know, had they not been homeschooling, this would have never happened. And I I have no doubt. I'm 99.5% on a lot of things. I am 100% sure that had these folks not homeschooled, there would have been no investigation. And, you know, with DCFS and CACD, God help you if you're a little different. And what's even worse with the Stanleys, what I found, is this system hates child abusers. And that's not a bad thing. But what they hate even worse than a child abuser is a child abuser who won't admit it. And so if you're innocent, and therefore if innocent people won't admit to child abuse, although sometimes they even do that, then there's no one lower than you as far as these agencies are concerned.
Yeah, and that makes it almost impossible because there are a lot of parents who will plead to anything or sign or agree anything just, you know, with the hopes, the carrot on the stick to get their kids back. We have Lori Fortin on the line as well, and she also has a question for you, Senator. And by the way, thank you so much for being so open and willing to share what you know and to answer the many, many questions that we have.
Hi,
Lori.
Hi, thank you. I want to know if it took you that much hoops to jump and things to figure out to get information on this case. Do you know they don't even share information with the actual parents? And what do you suggest that parents do?
We have to change the law. We have to change numbers of laws. And I'm speaking of my own state. First, we have to know what the problem is, of course, and that's one of the reasons I can't stop is we have dug down, our committee has dug down, and we are now more aware of the problem than any legislators in the state ever have been and understand the problems more than we ever have. But no, in our state, what folks can do, and I have people call me from across the state, and, of course, we're part-time legislators, so we jokingly refer to we have real jobs. But I stay bogged down, but I can get information. I can't share it with the parents. But if they call me and tell me that they're innocent, et cetera, and of course, keep in mind, not everyone who calls me and tells me they're innocent is innocent. But I can check and if it's really far out there like the Stanleys, I try to help. And we try to get, and there's other legislators. I'm not the only one. I'm the one who has spearheaded this, but we've got legislators across the state who have volunteered anytime I need their help, and especially if it's in their district. And I try, whenever possible, I try to get people to call their own legislators. And if they will work on it, I say, you have them call me because I know how much they don't know because I know what I didn't know.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to point out, too, something that you said that was very powerful is that until, you know, this case was actually brought to your attention, you really had no idea what was going on. And so many people don't have any idea what's going on, and they believe this system is simply there to help abuse children. So, if they're keeping state senators in the dark, you know, imagine your average person. And I'm going to ask you, Senator Clark, if you could just also mention a few of the things you've done, because I know you've been working with a lot of people and you've taken a lot of steps to try to actively change and correct these problems and issues with the system.
Well, we're working on legislation. I mean, the main thing we've done is an investigation. And if we had talked a month ago, I would have a very different attitude and a very different story because after we uncovered this email, and at the same time, we also have the administrative office of the courts. We have problems in the judiciary. It's not just these other two agencies. And we had folks that we have parent counsel who will represent indigent parents, and they're under the same agency that the ad litems and that the judges are, and there's two, and CASA, the advocates for children, they're all under the same agency, and that's a conflict. And we've had two separate reports, independent reports, tell us that. I didn't understand it until I got involved. But they have actually perjured themselves. In order to keep political power, they have come before our committee, and we're the one of the few committees in the state that has the power to swear people in, and for no other reason than to hold on to political power, at least none that I can see. other than the, and we have, and I don't use the word perjury lightly. If I didn't have the recordings of what they said and then emails that we've obtained that proves that what they said was untrue. So they really, when coincidentally, when I had both this email and the evidence of perjury, we were hit from the blind side, and they tried to remove our funding. They tried to shut down the investigation. It was just really pretty dark after we had done so much work uncovering all of this. Then the email was released, and a report, DCFS had a report done. Actually, the governor says he had it done, about the Arkansas foster care population went up 30% in 17 months. And so they questioned why. And evidently, again, I'm conjecturing that they did not like the answers because they buried this report. The company that gave them the report that we spent $5 million with so a year, so evidently we think they're competent. But someone knew about it. Again, someone had to know about it, and the Arkansas Times and Northwest Arkansas knew about it and did a Freedom of Information Act request, and it came out last week. And it vindicated these Horn Thiesel or Associates interviewed 80 DCFS workers and five judges and came back with what they believe the problems were. And it was not just one or two things. It's a number of things. And we're working on legislation for that. And so we're working, to answer your question, we're working on legislation that's recommended in this report. We're working on other legislation, including legislation on transparency, and where we can look into things versus being shut out. We've also, I met with the governor this past week. I met with the Speaker of the House this past week. I met with the head of DHS. Most of those meetings, there were other people there with me. The governor has now, I think he was always interested in this. He's had task force and other things. He's just been governor for 2 years now, less than 2 years. But he finally appointed someone in his office who gets it, who truly understands it. And I believe that I can partner with this person, and I believe we're going to make headway. The new we have someone that's been over DHS, which is the Department of Human Services, which is the umbrella organization that DCFS is under, huge department. I believe she gets it. First person there that I think understands the depth of the problems, and they're not going to change overnight. But we've talked about the structural problems. We've talked about the need for transparency, the need for quality control. I explained in my business how terrible it would be if the only way people could get us to react to their complaints was to take us to court. And that's the way DCFS works. I said, you should have a quality control within above your county and district supervisors and below the level that people can complain to, that they can go over the heads. And a lot of these complaints won't be real. They won't be the people may be guilty, et cetera. But you're just like I'm hearing them, you're going to hear from the people who are really innocent. And you're going to find out where your problems are. And as you deal with those problems, your other problems are going to start to go away. And why they've not thought of these kind of things, I don't know. But, you know, I've suggested that they get somebody to come in, not to run the agency, but someone who understands how to set up an agency that really provides customer service, that really helps children and families, and for a year or so, two maybe, to really put this structure in place to the way the organization should be run to really help children and families, because that type of person probably is not going to stay. But get it set up, get people trained, and because we do need protect. It's people forget, but when they've been abused by the system, they forget that there are still children that are suffering terrible things. And we've been careful and moved a little slow because I don't want to swing the pendulum too far the other direction. And anyway, I hope I answered your question there.
And I did want to highlight something that you mentioned that we have encountered with many professionals and we've covered on previous shows, is that when you do go after these agencies and try to hold them accountable and make these changes, you face retaliation at every level. I mean, we've seen it, attorney generals. Now we're hearing from senators, mandated reporters, and that is an issue. It's so endemic in our system that they actually retaliate against the people that are trying to fix it. I know Brian Kinter also has another question for you, Senator.
Okay.
Go ahead, Brian. Ada?
Brian, your mic's open? I guess not. His mic is open, so I don't know.
There you go. I got you.
There you are.
Good to find you.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, is that, and just as everybody here is talking about this, your enormity of the challenges that you have, what's your position on these judges and others that have the so-called blanket absolute immunity when the U.S. Supreme Court has already established in Hafer versus Milo that there's no such thing as absolute immunity? So how do these judges and these CPS workers get away with these types of brutality, and it just it escapes it? I mean, right now there's a case in California, the Duval case, and they're arguing right now that a CPS worker is protected because she can lie and commit perjury as long as she perceives that it's for the best interest of the child. And I'm saying, how did we transgress to such a level of depravity?
Well, the privacy laws, and the privacy laws are understandable, but the privacy laws give such, you know, obscurity and lack of transparency that they start to think, it appears to me, they start to think that they can keep anything secret. And when you can keep anything secret, lots of people are not going to act as well as they would have in another situation. But, you know, I have immunity as a state senator, but I do not have immunity for wrongdoing. And so, I mean, that's a high bar to climb, but I'm not familiar with the Supreme Court decisions, but I think if a DCFS worker or a judge can be proven to have acted, you know, not just a wrong decision, not just a mistake, but actually done something criminal, and perjury is certainly criminal, then they should answer. There should be consequences.
And I know that Jim Black also had a question about immunity, but a different question along the same lines.
Yes, Senator. Does Arkansas have an statute, rule, or code, anything that raises the bar on immunity above the federal good faith immunity? Like Texas, we have a multi-level statute that adds to it that an employee is not immune if they commit perjury, fabricate evidence, knowingly conceal or intentionally withhold information that would establish that a person alleged to commit child abuse did not commit child abuse or violate state or federal law in the investigation or prosecution of a suit. Now, whenever I research qualified immunity or good faith immunity, there's a little subclause that if there is pre-existing law that overrides that, they have to follow the pre-existing law. So do you know if Arkansas has that in place to where they could draw upon that?
I actually have absolutely no idea. One of the things I've learned as a legislator is state government is huge. And actually my specialty is education. I have a passion for K-12 education and chair the Senate chair of the Education Caucus. I've developed a passion for this, but lots I don't know, and that's one thing I absolutely cannot answer.
And I know, Brian, you said you had a quick question, too, along the same lines here.
Yes, I wanted to ask the senator here because he's saying that he's not immune for an action that he takes, you know, in a private portion of his job. The question beckons, though, is that how does a private individual obtain that objective of holding the people accountable when it's a judge that violates your rights because you're going to the judiciary making an argument about the judiciary, and it has become abundantly clear across the nation that the judiciary has pretty much said, we're not going to hear you, so you never even get a trial, and which is a violation of law as well. So where you go for a remedy or relief, and by your own acknowledgement, some senators and congressmen, they can't get involved. So the judiciary basically has a stranglehold upon the people, and it's come to tyranny.
Well, I can't disagree with that. There are lots of wonderful judges, good people, and some of these jobs, especially in juvenile courts, I would not want to have. I'd hate to be making these decisions. Having said that, we see judges that that just flat out make rulings, especially the more familiar I become with it, that in no way follow the law. Of course, I have to be careful. I'm a legislator, and we have, you know, we're separate branches, and the judiciary will tell me very quickly it's none of my business. It is many ways a whole lot my business, but what I in turn tell them is, if you don't want the legislature to mess with it, if you don't want us messing with the judiciary, then you need to clean it up. And they have more power to clean up the judiciary than they have exercised. And if they don't do it, someone else is going to have to.
And I'm going to ask you to stay on the line, Senator Clark, because I'm sure people will have more questions for you. And I have to say, you've been excellent. Thank you for being so open and honest and answering so many questions that people rarely have the chance to actually sit down and speak with someone like you who has this knowledge and to understand exactly what's going on at these different levels. And before we get to discussing the bill that we're going to discuss later, I'm going to ask you a few questions again. But before that, we do have a senatorial candidate, Bruce Nathan, on the line. And my sort of opinion is that when we have people like Senator Clark in power, those are the right people being there. Now, when we have someone like Bruce Nathan running for senator and the person that he's running against is not taking up these issues seriously, then these are the new people we need to vote in. So, Bruce, I'm going to ask you to tell us your opinion on these issues and where you stand, what your platform is on these issues involving children and families and CPS issues.
Well, good evening, wherever you are. This is quite the thing. So as she said, my name is Bruce Nathan. I am running for the everybody knows this gentleman whose seat I'm trying to take. His name is Marco Rubio, and he ran for president in the state of Florida. He lost that bid to Donald Trump. Donald Trump and Marco Rubio do not see eye to eye, although they're in the same party. There's a lot of downtrodden actual hatred toward Marco Rubio in this state right now because he has not done anything for 6 years. So that's the problem, and I think we see that with all of our politicians that are out there today that are just become professional politicians. They don't do anything for us anymore. Now, and if we're going to go to specifics of family law, I can tell you right now, Marco Rubio has not, and Bill Nelson, who's our, there's one Republican and one Democrat, just so, you know, you can have obviously two and two or whatever, or split it like they have. But they have not done anything for family law reform in this state at all. And our governor here is Governor Rick Scott, and he's probably, I would say bar none, if not the worst governor Florida's ever seen, might be the worst governor that the United States has ever seen. So, because he's the corruption level is extremely high, and it's whoever's putting money into his pocket. He was, before he got here, just to give you a background on Governor Rick Scott that's here now, he was indicted for Medicare fraud prior to becoming governor. So you gotta love getting a governor in here that's already been indicted on a crime. So that's the way our state in Florida has run. So I'm running for United States Senate because I needed to run something where I could have actually possibly a federal investigation on Rick Scott and all the corruption that he has. This is our big problem is that we need to have people that are willing to get into the government at a higher level, U.S. government, United States Senate, to be able to make sure that we can have true accountability and be willing to really put their body in front of that, in front of the money, and say, I will not accept any money from people who are going to do wrong towards the citizens of this country. The big citizens of this country, in my world, are our children, of which I have six. So they are the pride and joy of my life. And they're the only reason why I am running, because the country is just going in the wrong direction. Now I heard the senator, the state senator, talk about legislation. There's so much talk about, and it happens with our state senators here too. There's so much talk about legislation that really just brings the whole, our state here, it's 2 months. It's probably 2 months for your state as well. It takes up so much time to just legislate these rules and regulations and trying to get things in. Nothing ever gets done. So in my idea, and somebody told me I can't do this, but I'm doing it anyway, is that there needs to be a Family Law Reform Act as a national referendum, because this is a national problem. And we have, and every state has a DCF that is corrupt, every single one. And every state has judges that are corrupt. And every state is under that Title IV D&E. So this is not a state-by-state problem. This is a national problem. Understand, I'm not a big government guy. I lean more conservative. I'm a big constitutionalist. I'm a smaller government guy. But when you have a big problem like this, that's when the federal government has to take over and has to say, wait a second, hold on now. We got a big problem. We have to start writing rules and regulations that's going to make it so that these people will comply. And then there's no ifs, ands, or buts. This way the states don't have to go and write the legislation and try and wrangle it out there for the 2 months they're there. This way it's already there and on the federal level, and we can make it happen and make it empowered immediately. And understand, I'm talking probably a little long, but you have to understand, because I'm an anomaly in the United States of America, and under the powers of the Constitution, me going in as a no-party affiliate, because I'm running as an NPA, which is very rare in all of the United States of America. Most of the people running in my position are called independents. But in the state of Florida, in the Division of Elections, I'm called no-party affiliation, which means under the Constitution, under what the framers put the Constitution together, means I would go directly to the top of the Senate, of the United States Senate, because I would not be subservient to the left or the right. The Republicans and Democrats have nothing to over me. I would go up there. If Donald Trump happens to be the president, I would be pretty sure that he would put me as pro temp, as president of the Senate, when the vice president is not there. Because the things that have to happen from people who are not politicians, which is myself. I'm a physical therapist in the real world, have a real job, which I really have to do every day to make my money. And this is the way it has to be. This is what the people are looking to get back into the Senate. We're all looking for 535 of them to go and bring new blood in, just like you were saying in the show. So I've probably spoken maybe too much now, so I'll let you say something.
Thanks. No, we kind of expect when we bring on lawyers and politicians and people who are trained to speak.
I want
to ask Senator Clark, because we do have Lori Fortin and Jim Black on to discuss a bill that is currently before the Senate, and we'll discuss what that bill's about in a little more detail. But first, I did want to ask Senator Clark, what exactly is involved in having a bill pass and then become law? Like, when they bring this bill before the Senate, what happens and how long does it take before that can actually be put into effect if it does indeed pass?
Okay, you're talking about the U.S. Senate, right?
Yes.
Okay. I want to share with you, Arkansas system is very, very close to the United States system. So once we write legislation and get co-sponsors, we would file it, and it would go to a committee, and it could go to public health, it could go to judiciary, but it'll be assigned to a committee. And on that committee, there'll be debate, discussions, etc. And you have to get a majority vote on that committee. Are you there?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. Get a majority
vote. Who is saying hello in the background?
I don't know. But you get a majority vote on that committee. If you don't get a majority vote, then it's dead. If you get a majority vote, then it goes to the Senate floor, has to pass the Senate floor, and in the U.S. Senate that requires 60 votes. And then it would go to a House committee, and then it has to go through the same thing in the House. It passes there, it goes to the House floor. If it passes there, and if it's not amended anywhere along the way and doesn't have to start all over again, then it would go to the president. And at the U.S. level, at the federal level, that can take a very long time. It can take I've been involved in some federal legislation and some other business interest. And, depending on the level of interest and the level of support, it can be from a few months to a number of years to actually get something through.
And, Lori, I'm going to come to you and ask you to explain the highlights and the most important parts of the Family First Preservation Act bill that is before the Senate currently. And I know there are a couple of holdouts, and we'll fully understand what it's about.
Sure. The Family First Act, first off, it has been through the House. The House voted unanimously for it, and now it's in the Senate. What it does is we believe a lot of this corruption arises from money, surprise, surprise, but it seems there are perverse incentives in the federal laws of the Social Security Act, Title IV, E, and D, that gives the states or the counties, depending on how your state social service agency is run, money, but it only kicks in for the removal of children. And that's what we believe gives a perverse incentive to remove children rather than work with children in their homes. And a lot of these cases where children are removed, it's not outright child abuse. Child abuse does happen, and we're totally against child abuse when it happens, and police have to be involved in DAs and there's charges. But a lot of the reasons that children are removed, it's neglect or it's outright either a false report coming in and they go with it, or issues that could be easily solved with services in the home. So a couple of Senators Wyden and Hatch, developed this bill with help from one of our people in our group, Kathleen Arthur, who's actually, she's been working so hard. She's on vacation. So me and Jim are stepping in, explaining this act for this show tonight. And what it does, it's called Preventive Services Act, Family First Preventive Services. You would think the prevention was on child abuse, and it's actually not. The prevention is on foster care, and your psychologist would agree that removal from the home is a trauma, not only for that family, but for that child. And a lot of work, depending on what the outcome is once a removal is made, a lot of psychology and work has to be done for that child to be well again. This without any other abuse. But we also know that 80% of abuse, neglect, and sexual abuse happens once in foster care, not at the hands of the biological families that they were removed from. So what this bill says is before you can remove a child in the home, this money will be made available for reimbursement. That's how it works. For preventive services in the home. And what we also know is that, right here in Massachusetts, 80% of us grandmothers, and I'm one of them, are raising their grandchildren because of this opioid addiction going on. And it's all over the country, not just Massachusetts. So what this money will also be allowed to be used for, reimbursed for, is treatment for the parents. In both the opiate and mental health. Usually they go hand in hand, whether you start self-administering drugs for whatever mental health illness, or if you use drugs so long, you can get some mental health. I'm not a doctor. Maybe your doctor can comment on that. But trends show you that most of the reasons why CPS or DCF is involved in a case is because of opiate and mental health reasons. So the money is allowed to be used for treatment for those parents, because right now all they have to do for money to kick in to help that kid is to remove the child, which causes more harm to the family, to the child, and then doesn't even fix their parents. And parents fare better. Many studies show parents fare better even from so-so homes. I'm not talking outright child abuse, but so-so homes, poor homes, in their homes rather than being removed. So the money allows for that, and it also allows for those parents that aren't substance abuse or mentally challenged, mentally health challenged, provisions for evidence-based parenting courses or parenting classes, or it just gives the money for that. And services has to be in place at least a year before any money can be used for that child once removed. So we feel that this is, of course, the way to go, because, you know, your senators or your prospect senators that we're talk about how money is sometimes the incentive to for these cases. And also a very important part of it is the residential care, the congregate care, that a lot of kids are in these facilities that on paper, I do a lot in my state. I read proposals of people looking to get state contracts to serve these children. On paper, they're beautifully therapeutic placements. Family is always welcome. But I also do focus groups on the parents and the children that are in these facilities, and that's not the way it works. We've asked teenagers, why are you here? And they say there was no other placement, or DCF doesn't like me, or it's a perception of a teenager, but shouldn't they know that they're there for therapeutic reasons? And they don't, because they probably are not there for that reason. But we know that foster care industry is a $1 billion industry, and a lot of that money goes to the smallest percentage of those kids that are in these residential and group home settings and STAR programs in my state that's stable, a short-term until another placement. They're like warehouses, a short-term place until another placement can be found. And so what this does is that's the most restrictive placement for a child and the most expensive. So what this bill does is allow only 2 weeks of stabilization services for children that need that level of care, and then all other care has to be in a family setting. It also gives money for that family setting if it cannot be with the biological parents. And like if parents are taking advantage of the treatment offered for mental health or substance abuse, and so an alternate caretaker would be needed, it gives money only if that alternate caregiver is a family member, and not to stranger foster care any longer, where kids' outcomes are less positive. So that's the.
Ladies, are you still there? Like you got muted.
They mentioned about how often they end up on drugs, psychiatric drugs, because of their grief and their loss, and suddenly their special needs because they're emotional. Go ahead, Jen.
Deborah, we lost the first part of your sentence. Can you repeat your sentence, and we'll ask Jim Singer to come on.
Hi, sorry. We're going to go to Dr. Singer, Dr. Jim Singer, because Lori had made a couple comments where she had said a doctor would know this, and one of them was to do with the trauma involved when you do remove a child from a home that is not physically or sexually abusive. It's an issue that, you know, simple home supports could have solved. And secondly, you know, how often this leads to these children being medicated because of the trauma of being removed from their home.
Well, that's very important. But I guess that they need to first do an accurate and valid diagnosis to determine, first of all, what is the underlying problem and whether staying in the home or, in this case, perhaps being removed from the home is going to help or exacerbate the problem, make it worse. And the
definitely. And then what are the, you know, what are the odds that the children will end up being medicated and often even labeled special needs because of their emotional issues when they're ripped from their family?
Well, the answers to that question are really twofold. First of all, if there is trauma or some kind of emotional problems, those have to be accurately diagnosed in an objective way, in the best interest of the child. But in some cases, children are abused medically, and there is misdiagnosis, and sometimes it can even be intentional, where the children are misdiagnosed and actually given a medical straitjacket, where they're sedated in order to control them or keep them quiet. So, again, we need to be acting in the best interest of the child and protecting the rights of the child and also the protective parent.
And Jim Black, we have two Jims here. I know you and Lori have been working together on this bill, and I believe I did hear her mention that one of the main parts of this bill would provide funding to provide supports in the home and thereby reduce foster care placements, and this would be for up to 12 months of family services in the home instead of having money incentives to remove children from the home. Could you maybe tell us one or two more important highlights of this bill should it go through? And again, it's the Family First Prevention Services Act.
Yes. One thing I wanted to point out, a lot of people don't realize that not all families get that Title IV funding. And one thing that this bill opens up for the 12 months of prevention services is almost all families are eligible to get this funding that is not available to a lot of families now. Another thing is they are for reunification. Right now there is a 15-month cap on reunification. This bill removes the 15-month cap, and they will offer reunification services for longer than 15 months. And also, should the child come home, they then add a 15-month extension for services within the home to prevent recidivism. That's something that almost nobody mentions about this bill. There's another area that different ones has been concerned about the bill is that it opens up funding to help with interstate placement of children. And some of the opponents are saying this is going to open up for more kids to be adopted. But what I, how I see this, I'm dealing with a case right now that we have come right up almost to terminate parental rights. The state refuses to place the children with their grandmother or great-grandmother. So we're trying to get a great aunt in Georgia to step in, and the state is delaying the certification of her home, and that is a little bitty small portion in this bill that almost nobody pays attention to, is getting that funding to where an interstate database so that children can be placed with family in other states. I have seen grandparents come to Texas and almost go broke, staying in hotels.
Jim, could you move to a clearer location? There is a lot of static on your line, and we're having trouble hearing you. Just to reiterate so people can hear, because you are really getting staticky, it's prevention services in the family to help avoid unnecessary removal, and it's reunification services to help families reunite. And then I believe there's also a part of the bill that has to do with adoption. And if you could move to a slightly clearer location and explain that as well.
Okay. What that last portion is has to do with a database for what they call ICPC, which is checking out family members across state lines. That now takes approximately a year. And for, so often, families that's going with CPS, they will wait until the absolute last minute to tell other family members about what's going on. And it's almost like when you have a terminally ill person, you generally don't tell the rest of the family until they go on hospice. And then you need to move quickly to take care of whatever other arrangements. And that's a situation we see very often, is at the last minute they reach out to family members in other states, and the system is just too slow to make that placement possible, so the child ends up going to non-family. And there's a very small portion of this bill that addresses that. Right offhand, I can't think of too much other on this, other than it does readjust how families are paid on the front end. And that's one thing that we have always had an upside-down system. And most of prevention is handled through 4B funding, which is block grants, which are capped. And now they're moving this 4E funding to the front end, which is uncapped entitlements. So the state can spend a whole lot more money keeping children in the home. When I say it's upside down funding, right now it's like 9.8% for prevention, and the remaining is to break up the family. And I don't have any percentages on how this will totally affect under the new guidelines, but anytime you can make it more profitable to do the right thing than the wrong thing, you'll start seeing some of the corruption start disappearing.
Okay, and Bruce Nathan had a question about the bill, and I have to say Jim Black and Lori are much more familiar with the ins and outs of this bill, so Bruce, I would suggest maybe directing your question to Jim or Lori here, because I'm not exactly sure of the answer when it comes to this bill.
Well, the question is, because all bills have multiple things in them for multiple people. One of the things that I'm going to propose and make happen is bills should all be standalone bills. If you have to have 20 bills, 20, five bills go out in one day, each one should be a standalone bill, all by itself without anything else in it. So, and we call that extra stuff in there pork. So the question is with this bill, how much pork is in it?
There is not nearly as much as I have seen in other federal bills. We tried to, I am happy that this bill does not go as far as we actually want it to go, because something that a lot of people don't understand about federal legislature, since child protection is not within the 18 powers enumerated in the Constitution for the federal government to be in charge of, the 10th Amendment pushes that duty off onto the states. So all the federal government can do is write a general bill, and then the state legislatures have to apply their constitutional objectives to that, to apply that bill in each state. So since this bill mostly does not directly affect the state, only the states on a couple of areas, it was mostly changing the direction of funding. I like it because should we not get the people to rally in the states to properly apply this bill, there is not enough in it to do a lot of damage, and then we can come back and say, we told you so, now pay attention to how legislation gets passed to the states. And that's what one of the positive things that I see in this bill is it's got just enough to get the state's attention, and we can get the people to rally. But should they not rally and it goes the wrong direction, it won't be that much damage, so to speak.
Thank you so much, Jim, for explaining that for us. And I know Dr. Jim Singer, we have a couple Jims on tonight, had a question for Senator Clark. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, thank you. Senator, I wanted to ask, I've been contacted by staff from several congressional committees, and actually there are so many child fatalities that Congress authorized a federal commission to investigate why so many children are unfortunately dying. And I was amazed when I contacted this federal commission that they not only were aware of the cover-up of the child abuse that I did report, but I was told by staff from the commission that my documentation was actually sent to the esteemed members of the commission. And everybody says this is horrible, and there's supposed to be a congressional investigation, and then things always hit a brick wall.
Yes, and was there a question?
Yes. I was just wondering how any of these legislative committees can actually do an investigation, because I have a report from the state police that confirms violations of the crime codes by the government exist and misusing government money to cover up child abuse.
Okay, now is this federal or legislature company or is it state?
It's both.
Okay,
well, but I have been contacted by staff for congressional leadership, and yep. And also there were letters written by both congressional committees and state legislative committees as well.
If I was on a federal level, if I was trying to get my congressman to look into this, I would contact him and his staff directly, and I would try at some point to visit with him directly. That's easier for some with some congressmen than it is others.
Sure.
On the state level, every state is different. And the Arkansas legislature formed the Joint Performance Review Committee back in the mid to late 90s. And it is all but dormant. But it is what public health could look into some of these matters, judiciary could look into some of these matters in the state of Arkansas. We do have Joint Performance Review, which can look into anything. And it just so happened that I and my co-chair wanted to look into this. But I can't tell you about another state whether they would have a committee like this or not. And what kind of investigative powers they have from state to state.
So in other words, it varies from state to state. Then they're not all uniform.
It does, good state legislators are going to be willing to sit down and talk with you and tell you how the system works in your state, and advise you. Even if I didn't care about the issue, if someone came to me, if they wanted to get something done about anything, I would explain the system and where they would have their best chances of getting something done. And I'm sure there are legislators in your state that care. They may not yet be aware of the problems, and that's one of the things we're working on is making them aware. But you definitely, even if it's not your legislator, start with them, but you know, reach to the district next to you or to the chairman of a committee that you think would be plausible, and keep trying until you can talk to someone.
Well, thank you, and I wanted to let you know that I've done that, and I've reached out to virtually every prosecutorial level, from the county up to the state and the U.S. attorney. I've also been contacted by the headquarters for the FBI in Washington, and there's still inconsistent claims between the feds in Washington and the field office in the state. So for some reason, who's ever covering this up has considerable powers.
Well, I've only been a state senator for 4 years, and this is just practical advice. But I can tell you before that I was active in politics, and it's amazing how many people are not. And during campaign, especially with your state legislators or candidates, around campaign time, find event that they're going to be at. Find when they're going to be in your town. Find when they're, you know, and don't hesitate. I know this sounds crass. Don't hesitate to write them a check for $50. It's not that that buys you access. I'm just telling you that you have to have money to get elected, and people don't forget. And it's amazing. Sometimes you can catch somebody at a campaign event. Sometimes they may be very busy, but other times they may have plenty of time to talk. And sometimes it's we have to get involved in the system before they actually get to the Capitol. And but, again, that's just practical advice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That sounds good.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We're going to go to wrap-up comments now and give each of our guests a chance to make a final comment that you want to leave our listeners with. And in the case of Lori and Jim Black, when we get to you, I would appreciate you also mentioning where people can find the information, more information about this bill and how they can help get it passed. So we're going to start with senatorial candidate Bruce Nathan for your wrap-up comment. Thank you so much for coming on our show tonight, Bruce.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I only found out about parental alienation some 7-8 months ago. Through many people know all the people. It's like it's a network. You know, Randy Davis, Tim Scomo, Brian Kinner. So these are Neil Shelton. These are people that I've come to know over these months that I've been running for the United States Senate to try and find out more about how we can stop the craziness that's going on around our country, and something that we all know more and more about every day, but we feel, I think we all feel almost stifled by it because there's not, like one person said, the senator said, there's nothing specifically written in our Constitution that really helps to protect our children in a specific way, and then you have to go by the 10th Amendment and let it go state by state. And it's really, that becomes a problem because it's going to take time before things will actually get fixed then. And time is not something that we really have. As he was talking about getting things passed or bills passed, and sometimes it can take, you know, some months or years. And we the people who are not, I'm not politician. I know you mentioned politicians or regular speakers. I'm not that. I'm a medical practitioner. And when you go see a doctor, you want something fixed that day or tomorrow. If you have pain, you want somebody to tell you you're going to have pain, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to keep that pain for a couple of years? I don't think so. Not in today's society. So me doing this, running for United States Senate, makes it so that we, the people, are tired of this, and we need to make it so things happen faster and find ways to fix the problems quickly instead of letting them linger through legislation and everything else. So that's my whole purpose. I'm becoming the next United States Senator for Florida. So, again, my name is Bruce Nathan, and I'm happy to be speaking with all of you people And I'm just going to give you my website, brucenathan2016.com, or you Google Bruce Nathan these days, and I come up pretty quick. So I'm happy to have any conversations off the air with any of you or any people that you know of anytime, in the state of Florida, out of the state of Florida. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Bruce. And Lori Fortin, we're going to come to you next. Quick wrap-up comment, and just let people know where they can find information about this bill.
Okay. Excuse me. Jim will tell you where to find information, but what I would like to ask from your listeners, if they support this bill that also takes away the adoption bonuses that both adopted parents get and the state gets. So right now, there's 100 senators. 97 of them are okay with this bill. There's 3 senators that are holding out for this to become, go to the President Obama's desk to sign into law, and they are Senator Boxer, who can be reached in her D.C. office at 202-224-3553. She's from California. Senator Enzi is from Wyoming. His number is 202-224-3424. And the last one is Senator Cornyn from Texas. And he actually is the most important one from Texas because he won't even say why he's holding out on the bill. The other 2 senators from California and Wyoming, they wanted an amendment in. But like your guest has said, once you put an amendment in, the whole process starts over. We don't have
Thank
much
you so
time.
Much. That's a great wrap-up comment. I'd like to go to Jim Black as well. We got 30 seconds for Jim. Please come on.
Yes. What we have a Facebook group that is public called FFA Triage, and we will be posting updates to this as we go along. One important thing is we need to put the lame duck session starts November 14th. We need to be pushing our senators to get this out of the Finance Committee and get it moving, because if there is significant changes, it has to go back to the House, and we have less than 20 days to wrap this bill up in this session. So we've got to get it moving.
Exactly. And thank you so much for coming on and making people aware of this bill. And you can contact us at NASCA if you didn't catch all the information from Lori and Jim Black. Senator Clark, I'd like to come to you for a wrap-up comment. And I do want to thank you so much. You fielded a lot of questions and you gave us an incredible amount of information. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Well, Deborah, thank you for having me. I'd be glad to come back anytime. The only reason that I support a federal fix is because the federal law has messed up much of this. But I really appreciated what Lori and Jim had to say. Lori, I guess, mostly. The problems you described that this bill would fix are exactly the same problems we've found. 18% of kids in foster care in Arkansas in 2008 were drug-related. Today is 56%. Even where parents are guilty, keeping children in homes, relative placement are 2 of the big things we're fighting for that they talked about in that bill. The trauma, if kids are, even if they have mild abuse, how much worse are they hurt if they're taken out of the home? So it sounds like they're doing some very good work there, and I want to encourage them and everyone. Hopefully we're going to make some progress in Arkansas and maybe be a leader in showing other people how to get it done.
Okay, I don't know where Deborah and Gina are, but we appreciate your being here. I want to thank all the guests
here
tonight.
Thank you so much. We just wanted to quickly wrap up and say how grateful we are for all the voices that have come forward and spoke out and for trying their best to change what is right now a really tough situation for families and children. Thank you as well, Bill.
And as Deborah said, you can write to nasca.forourkids@gmail.com, nasca.forourkids@gmail.com to get in touch with them. And Deborah and Gina are keeping the contact information for all the guests, and they'd be delighted to help. I want to thank the both of them and all their guests. Deborah and Gina do a terrific job pulling this show together, every other week. It's every other Thursday, always at the same time and place, 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 Central, 6 Mountain, and 5 Pacific. We do 6 shows a week. Every night except Saturday night, we do a different version of the Stop Child Abuse Now show. But this is an important one, and it brings us a unique following. If you're interested in the series of shows that are in this series, go to nasca.org/forourkids. And all the shows, including this one, you'll find there listed in the archive as on-demand versions. This is Bill Murray inviting you to join us whenever you can, and finishing the show by saying, as usual, may God bless you and the children of the world, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
I'll love tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was blue.
Blog Talk Radio.